afternoon I'd like to explore the theme of compassion. I started to practice when I was 17, when I found myself living in a Tibetan village in India. And the reason, the thing that it really most deeply inspired me to begin practicing was in that time, around 1970, living in this village that was really a village of refugees who had not been actually long out of Tibet, many of them. And even by Indian standards, it was an incredibly impoverished community. And knowing that many of the people, many of the refugees in that village had endured really tremendous trials and tremendous suffering that led them to end up being in India. Many of them had seen their families murdered. Some had been beaten, tortured. All of them, every one of them, without exception, had suffered tremendous loss and tremendous hardship beyond anything of my imagining. And yet, what I found in that community was this tremendous undimmed radiance of heart, this remarkable sense of often joy, generosity, warmth, and incredible forgiveness. In living in this community for a number of years, I never heard one of these people speak harshly of their abusers, their jailers, their torturers. And what I saw that they all had in common was not only a tremendous faith certainly in the teaching, in the tradition, in the practice, but they also seemed to share this really rather unshakable compassion. In fact, this was so curious to me, it's so puzzling how this could be, that was my initial inspiration to practice, to try to understand how this could come into being or really exist in such an obviously very genuine and sincere way. And within the early years of my own practice and training, of course, compassion was placed very centrally within the teaching. In fact, the way I was taught was that everything that we did in practice was out of compassion. That meditation in itself was a gesture of compassion in the service of deeper compassion. And I've explored this a lot over the years. I've explored what it really means, you know, when the Buddha talks in the suttas that, you know, the reason we practice is compassion. I'm trying to understand what it means, you know, and understanding that it means certainly we all have moments when compassion is very real to us in our life, when we're faced with some tremendous suffering or pain and we feel our hearts open and tremble, and that very natural, profound sense of being able to respond to suffering in such a simple, clear way. I've also come to understand that compassion has so many different threads within it, that it's certainly more than just a feeling. That there's such a profound wisdom or liberation of heart that is really asked for us to really be able to rest in that kind of responsiveness and openness and depth in the face of suffering. And it's very central in this tradition. One of the ways that it's really manifested is through what is called the Bodhisattva vow. It's a something that is recited and repeated. It says, though the many beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Though greed, hatred, and ignorance rise endlessly, I vow to end them. Though the Dharma is vast and fathomless, I vow to understand it. Though the Buddha's way is beyond attainment, I vow to embody it fully. Now this vow is repeated in countless temples and monasteries and by individuals around the world on a daily basis. And what this vow is a constant inner reminding. It's a remembering or a recommitment to the essence of the meditation practice, to the essence of a spiritual path. It's a recommitment to that in people's hearts and minds. And I'd like to just give you a little bit of a history, if I may, of one of the ways in which this teaching of compassion has really emerged over the centuries. Sometime around the first century AD in northern India, what is now Afghanistan, there was composed one of the most graceful and powerful texts in the Buddhist tradition, and it was composed in Sanskrit. And over the years, it's come to be known as the Lotus Sutta. And the central theme of this sutta or discourse is the portrayal of this very powerful and boundless compassion, which is said to be the embodiment of an enlightened mind, the embodiment of a liberated heart. And this compassion, it's said, is boundless enough that it pervades all the corners of the universe, relieving pain and anguish and suffering wherever it touches. And in the Lotus Sutta, in this text, it's the first place that the tradition of the Bodhisattva emerged. It was expressed in this sutta. The Bodhisattva was portrayed in this deity of Avalokiteshvara, which translated means one who listens to the sounds of the universe, or one who hears the cries of the world. And when the Lotus Sutta was translated into Chinese sometime around 400 AD, the name Kuan Yin began to emerge, something that we are more familiar with, probably most of us. And this deity of Kuan Yin has continued to occupy a very central place in this teaching, this practice, ever since. And over the centuries, Avalokiteshvara, or Kuan Yin, has been portrayed really in a variety of different ways. Perhaps some of you have seen this portrayal or this deity where Kuan Yin is depicted as a kind of feminine presence with a very serene face, with a very graceful body. And unlike other Buddha statues, she sits often with her arms outstretched and her eyes open. And what is really depicted is this very receptive, very warm, very embracing presence. And Kuan Yin is often shown as being seated, there's a Kuan Yin here, seated on a lotus flower. And the lotus flower is a symbol of in this tradition of the lotus is a symbol of the deepening, the opening, the flowering of the heart and mind. And very often Kuan Yin is shown, in one hand she holds a book of discourses, a book of suttas. which is said to portray her understanding of emptiness. On the other hand, she holds a vase, which is a symbol of the pouring out of this bottomless love and compassion. And yet, she's also been manifested or been portrayed in other ways. Sometimes she's portrayed as holding a willow branch, which again, in my understanding, in Chinese symbolism, is a symbol of the capacity to bend before the most fierce storms and winds in life, and yet also not be broken, being able to come back upright. And the weeping willow is said to be a synonym for the compassionate care for the ills of the world. Sometimes Avalokiteshvara is shown with 1,000 arms and hands, and in the center of every hand is an eye. And the eye, all those 1,000 eyes, are said to be a symbol of the constant awareness of suffering and the all-embracing compassion. I think another portrayal, which is sometimes puzzling to us, is that sometimes Kuan Yin is depicted as being this armed warrior who comes with this multitude of weaponry, like a medieval fighter, with a crossbow and thunderbolt and spear and bow and arrow and shield, which is said to be an embodiment of the commitment to protecting life, to the fierce compassion, which is uprooting the causes of anger. Sometimes Kuan Yin is portrayed in a masculine form. And in all of these different portrayals, there are these different elements of protection, of guardian, of wisdom, of fearlessness. Now, I have always been taught and always come to understand that these different portrayals of Kuan Yin, or these different portrayals of compassion, are not at all an invitation to create some idealized and distant aspiration that's somehow projected into the future, but that these different portrayals are really intended to encourage us to appreciate the different faces of compassion. And it's very important, I think, not to be dualistic. I think sometimes we can be very naturally, very spontaneously drawn towards this receptive, gentle, serene element of compassion. And yet the other side of that is this commitment to fearlessness, to honesty, to truthfulness, wholeheartedly engaging with ending suffering and its causes. So there are perhaps, you know, within compassion, both of these aspects. One is the aspect of this profound receptivity, and the other is the aspect of this agency, this embodiment. And the two together really form a whole. The central to profound compassion, it's a very simple commitment to the end of suffering and sorrow in all of its forms, and equally a commitment to ending the causes of suffering in all its forms. Compassion is said to emerge out of a very profound understanding of emptiness, and yet if it is genuine, it engages unconditionally with this world of very real people, very real events. It engages very unconditionally with this world where there is loss and sorrow and hatred and anger and grief. In the Diamond Sutta, it said that Any bodhisattva who undertakes the practice of meditation should treasure one thought only. Understanding perfect wisdom, I will vow to liberate all beings from the wheel of suffering and sorrow. And yet, when vast, unthinkable myriads of beings have been liberated, truly no being has been liberated. Why? Because no bodhisattva who is a true bodhisattva entertains such concepts as self or others. Thus, there are no sentient beings to be liberated and no self to attain perfect wisdom. I think this statement, which seems paradoxical, it is one that illustrates this very powerful marriage of both understanding the nature of emptiness and yet being very fully present in this world of beings who do suffer, who do experience pain and anguish. Now, the classroom of compassion, it must be said, in the classroom of the bodhisattva, has to be in this life. The commitment to understanding the causes of and ending the sorrow in this life, that is what creates the mind and the heart of the bodhisattva. I mean, anyone at all can be compassionate from a distance. Certainly when I lived on my Himalayan hillside, I found it easy to have compassion for all beings. Take me down into the Indian market, and it was a lot harder. Anyone can be compassionate, of course, when we're disturbed or we're unchallenged or we're flattered. But true compassion really isn't forged at a distance. I think true compassion is really forged in the fires that we experience in this life of conflict and alienation and struggle and sorrow and grief. As Shantideva said, as I mentioned the other day, whatever you are doing, ask yourself what is the state of mind. With constant mindfulness and alertness, accomplish good. That this is the practice of the bodhisattva. I think none of us have any doubt about the need for compassion in our world. It is something that seems to be sometimes sorely lacking. It's needed so urgently because in this life there can seem to be, what the Buddha called, an ocean of tears. A sorrow that at times feels bottomless. And if we're to respond at all, and to take our place in this life, first we have to be present. First we have to be present. To understand the causes of sorrow wherever it arises. And so compassion that is really not a mission. Compassion is not a mission about saving others or even serving others or even helping others. And then compassion surely must begin with our own willingness to probe beneath the surface of pain and to bring to an end its causes. I think it's so hard to understand how compassion is really an expression of wisdom, or maybe it's not so hard, an expression of an enlightened mind. In Milarepa's tremendous Indian yogi once said that long accustomed to contemplating compassion, I have forgotten all difference between self and other. It's clear that there is a universality to the experiences of grief, of anger, of fear, of rage, of distress, of frustration. I think sometimes when we're in the middle of any of those emotions or any of those struggles, we can be really convinced or feel that no one has ever felt exactly like this before. And yet there isn't any pain that we experience that hasn't been experienced before by another in a different time, in a different place. That does not in any way lessen or diminish our own suffering. But it more and more as we practice, we come to understand really the possibility not just of our heart, but the possibility of all human hearts to experience pain and joy. A very good friend of ours, a few years ago, her dearly, dearly beloved husband died, and to know this couple would to know almost like these two people were born to be married. They couldn't have married anybody else. They were both so eccentric and so weird, actually, that they could possibly have only married each other. And she said that when Lloyd died, she felt so isolated and so alone. And she said in a lot of ways her grief kind of was made worse, because after a time she felt she should have got over it, or people expected her to have moved on. And she said she felt kind of reluctant to impose the depth of her pain on other people. So when friends would ask her, you know, how are you doing? You know, she said that she would smile and say that she was coping, and yet she just felt what felt like a bottomless, endless grief. And she said at one point she kind of opted out of, you know, many of her close friends, not because she didn't appreciate their empathy and their support. But she went into a group, she said, where nobody knew her. And it was a group for people who'd lost someone close to them. And she said there was no agenda in the group. You know, they would just sit there, one after another, they would just talk quite openly, quite honestly about how they felt in their grieving. And they would listen. They would listen. And she said nobody was afraid of listening. Everybody knew the territory of grieving. And nobody was afraid of it. And she said after a time, you know, that she found this kind of innate compassion within that listening, not only from others, but she also found it within herself, listening to the story of another's loss. There is some pain in this life that is really not optional. We are born, we age, we experience, we love, we experience loss. Our hearts ache when we do experience those separations. But there is a lot of suffering in this life that really is optional. And when we really look at, you know, the conflicts and the wars and the violence that scars our world and scars so many individual lives, we see both on a personal level and on a kind of global level how much suffering is really born of a very profound and unquestioned belief that we exist separate and independent from the rest of the universe. And how we can feel and believe and live this separation, and it's no surprise, is it, that in the depth of that belief, it perhaps seems almost inevitable that one of the primary concerns in our life is going to be about our survival, about protecting and enhancing and defending this sense of self that can feel so isolated and separate. We can feel to be one very vulnerable, one very fragile self, living in a world of so many separate selves. And it doesn't always feel benevolent. We feel judged, we feel evaluated, we compete with other people, we feel anxious about other people. Sometimes we crave the approval of those other selves. We fear their disapproval. And it's often hard for us to appreciate about how our own feelings of vulnerability are reflected in the myriad of mirrors of countless beings around us. You know, a Christian mystic once said that anxiety is the mood of ignorance. And I think it's fairly obvious to us that anxiety and sadness are the mood of this feeling of isolation and separation. And sometimes that feeling of isolation and separation seems so hard to embrace, so hard to be with, that what we do is we fill our lives with camouflage. We can fill our lives with so much busyness and doing and distractedness so that we don't feel the pain of that separation. But sometimes I think that in protecting or trying to protect ourselves from that feeling, we do also deny ourselves the possibility of understanding that feeling of separation. Pablo Neruda wrote in his poem, Keeping Quiet, he wrote, "If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving, and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt this sadness of never understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us, as when everything seems dead in winter and later proves alive." How does this sense of separation manifest in our world? Well, this gap between self and other, it's not neutral. It's very rarely neutral. It's very rarely empty. In fact, this gap between self and other is where is where hatred grows, mistrust, anxiety, prejudice, fear. If you look at how much that scars our world, can any of it actually come into being without this sense of I and you, us and them? What this sense of separation does, this isolated self does, it I think in a very real way it segregates us from the rest of the world. We think of my body, my history, my family, my wants, my needs, my fears, my likes, my dislikes, my mind and my heart. All of this we say is what me I am. It's all the territory of me and mine, which somehow feels very separate from you and yours. And sometimes, you know, all of this that we call mine and me and I, sometimes it exists in harmony with others and sometimes it exists in conflict. Sometimes we have common bonds of preferences, of likes, of opinions. Maybe we even just support the same football team. And then we create an us versus a them. Again, sometimes existing in harmony and sometimes in conflict. A couple of years ago, in one of the big outbreaks of violence in Northern Ireland, this journalist tried to research how it came about. And what had happened is that two women went out shopping one day, one from the Catholic community and one from the Protestant community. And they were coming home from the store, and they, from opposite directions, met each other on the sidewalk. And they just both refused to give way. And, you know, the hostile glances turned into words of abuse that got more strident, and a crowd gathered, and stones were thrown, and someone was shot. Another story I came across around the same time was a story about two Canadian women who were both called out of their homes in Quebec somewhere during an ice storm. And one had to go and attend to her dying father, and one had some other family emergency to attend to. And they were traveling in opposite directions in their car and came across a tree that had fallen down across the road, barring their way. And both of them got out of their car, climbed over the tree, gave each other their car keys, turned the other's car around, and went on to do the whatever needed to be done. There may be choices here about this separation stuff. And yet if we don't understand those choices, we can almost on a daily basis practice this kind of unconscious apartheid that keeps us separate and closed to you and them, that somehow seems to threaten the foundation of me and us. We don't even know we're doing it sometimes. You know, we can take so much for granted. Recently I was spending some time with my family and speaking with my brother, and my brother and I live in very different worlds. He lives in Fort McMurray on an oil field with 23,000 other men. You know, isolated in this kind of weird life. And I, you know, sometimes he talks to me a little bit about what I do, you know, and we were talking about the subject of money. And I said, well, you know, I kind of like to try to lead a sort of relatively simpler life. I think people are happier often with that. He says, I'm not. He says, I want to make loads of money. He says, that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. I want to make loads of money. And it's so interesting, you know, and you feel those little twinges of like, what do you mean, you know? Why aren't you agreeing with me? You know, and it's just all those places we don't even know that we hold sometimes. Profound compassion really rests upon actually committing to understanding and dissolving this almost invisible barrier that keeps us imprisoned and separated. What we do understand in this practice is that isolation and delusion are not terminal illnesses and they are not life sentences. That we have the freedom to question, we have the freedom to investigate, we have the freedom to choose how we perceive ourselves in the world. As I mentioned, many of us, I'm sure all of us in our life, do have moments when those walls of separation just seem to crumble and dissolve. When we meet, are faced with something that is so tragic, so much suffering, that our hearts open. We embrace it. We are fully present. You know, we look at sometimes, you know, at what happens in our world. We look at those who survive a tsunami or an earthquake or live in the midst of a war, and somehow our hearts do quiver. Our hearts do tremble. I feel that part of meditation practice, or part of understanding this path, is really recognizing that that open heart, that trembling heart, it may not have to be just a lucky accident that we stumble across every now and again in our life. Something that is just left to chance. But that, in fact, in our practice, in our life, we can be really relentless in questioning separation and questioning and probing the ways that we might perpetuate separation. We can, through our practice and through investigation, really challenge this seeming impenetrable solidity of me. It's not enough, actually, just to want to be compassionate. It's not enough just to hold, you know, fantastic theories about emptiness. Somehow we really need to translate this into our life and into our experience. And this is, in a way, that the kind of fierce compassion and the fearless compassion, melting the barriers, exposing that wise vulnerability that really is our capacity to listen to the cries of the world. So what does this sense of me rest upon? You know, write a short autobiography. You know, and just begin every sentence with the word I. Well, it becomes pretty clear what this sense of me rests upon. You know, my appearance, my body, my mind, my personality, my history. This is the story of me. It's the story of me. Sometimes it seems like a very long story. In fact, it seems to begin even before we were even born, which it does, in truth. The story of me began before we were born. But it's not an eternal story. In fact, what we do see all the time, the way that we're constantly rewriting our story, and sometimes the story of me gets rewritten through new experience. Sometimes it gets rewritten through understanding. And it's only when this story of me is not questioned, is not explored, then it's like a finished book. It's like a finished manuscript. And then that's when we're truly imprisoned in our story. We say, this is the way I am. When I was trying to persuade my father many times that there might be an alternative to rage, he would say, this is the way I am. He said, if I had a temperament like yours, I'd probably do better. And I said, you think this was an accident? You know, you think I got this in a Christmas stocking somewhere? You know, this temperament of mine that you think might be a good idea? What we often see is that our story seems to be much written by what we cling to. Our story often seems to be written by what we identify with. You know, my gender, my prejudices, my race, my nature, my thoughts, my feelings. And when our story is written by what we cling to, then it continually fosters and solidifies separation. Because it continually fosters and solidifies the sense of me. The impenetrable nature, truth of me. And, you know, and then when our story is written by clinging, we actually really don't, we have an investment in separation, because we actually often in this life, surprisingly or maybe not surprisingly, we would actually really prefer our assumptions and our beliefs and our opinions are not challenged. You know, when somebody comes along and disagrees with you or tells you, you know, you're kind of wrong about something, do you say, thank you? Oh, thank you. You know, that's great news. You know, I really appreciate that. You know, a little more. You know, mostly we bristle. We bristle. We say, no, thank you. Because we would actually rather our assumptions and the sense of me is not challenged, because we think, who would we be? Who would we be? Fear is what keeps us holding and clinging. And holding and clinging keeps us fearful. A strange paradox. That fear motivates the clinging, and yet the very clinging makes us fearful. The stronger our fear is the degree that we really also want to also create the other. We objectify people. A couple of years ago, after the attack on the World Trade Center, we had a day-long retreat in London, and it was meant to be a sort of like so many people were traumatized by those events. That it was meant to be it was kind of advertised as sort of a day of healing. So it's kind of predictable who came, didn't it? I mean, it's people who wanted healing. You know, it's people who wanted understanding. So, you know, throughout the morning, people sat and they told the story of their shock and their sadness and their apprehension about what might come next. Except for one woman who came in the room, and she was really agitated, and she was really restless, and she was circling around the room. And then at some point she blurted out, she said, I don't want to hear this. She said, we need to retaliate. We need to kill the people who did this. And you could feel in this room this big in-breath and no out-breath. You know, it was like, you know, how could somebody possibly say that? You know, this sense of horror and embarrassment. And you could feel, I mean, it was so interesting the way it was immediately this sense of us and her. She became the other right away. She became the other, right? Immediately she became the other. And in her becoming the other, it was like, how much room was there for anyone to understand the story of her hurt, the story of where those words came from, the story of her pain. And I must say, to the credit of this community, there was the willingness to actually really just explore what happened in that moment. What does compassion mean in those moments when we are faced with what feels so strongly to be the other? You know, and it doesn't take us much to think of the other in our life, you know. People we dislike, our politicians, so many others. We haven't got enough time here tonight. But what does it mean to dissolve the separation between self and other? Well, actually, you know, it's like we have to cross the borders that we have created in our own heart and mind. We have to find the courage and the willingness to cross this territory, these lines, these parameters, these borders that we have written and created through our clinging. The alternative is to strike out in fear, or the alternative is to be lost in anger and in rage or self-righteousness. The alternative is to continually abandon the person who is right in front of us. And that is actually suffering. Suffering for another, suffering in ourselves. As Shantideva answered, he said, the mind does not find peace, nor does it enjoy pleasure or joy, nor does it find rest or courage when the thorn of hatred dwells in the heart. In brief, there is nothing that can make an angry person happy. Unruly beings are like space. There's not enough time to overcome them. Uprooting these angry thoughts is like defeating all of our enemies. We discover we can come back. We can come back to the person we are prone to abandon. Our story can be written by clinging. It can also be written by understanding and by compassion. Our willingness to understand and embrace the causes of suffering and end them. It's not to say we have no story. You know, we all have a story in this life. And, you know, your story is different than the person who sits beside you. And our story is born of the conditions of our life, over which we have not always had any control at all. And yet our story is not the whole of who we are. A teacher many of us had in India, Manindraji, once said, the thought of your mother is not your mother. The thought of yourself is not yourself. And our story is certainly no obstacle to profound compassion. You know, that embracing our story, we actually see that our story has a potential both for creating sorrow and it has a potential for evoking healing and joy. And somehow to understand even this one story, my story, somehow is to understand all stories, isn't it? And this is the path of the Bodhisattva. Milarepa again said, Just as I instinctively reach out to care for and heal a wound in my leg as part of my body, why should I not reach out instinctively to heal and care for the wound in another, wherever it exists, as part of this body? I do feel it's important to understand that to cultivate compassion, to understand, to feel compassion, is not to imply that we would never feel fear, or never feel outrage, or never feel anger. You know, when we are faced with injustice and harshness and prejudice and cruelty in our world, are we expected not to feel something? Of course we feel something. Sometimes it evokes anger. Sometimes it evokes very powerful feelings within us. And those very powerful feelings carry with them either the energy to awaken us or the energy to drown us. You'll think how awake we really feel when we're somehow angry or faced with something that is truly terrible. And yet, what do we do with those feelings? They can be translated into harm, or they can be translated into understanding. They can be translated into ways that perpetuate the very things we hate, or they can be translated into a fearless compassion. We cannot choose not to engage with this world we're part of, but we can choose how we engage with it. And certainly compassion does ask us to engage. To know when stillness is asked for. You know, sometimes the compassion of receptivity, of empathy, and of listening is all that is needed. In the face of sometimes profound suffering, our capacity to be just a little emptier inwardly is what enables us to truly listen to the cries of another, to the cries of the world. And this is a gift of fearlessness, of knowing that we can bend in the storms of life and knowing that we can come back upright. Compassion also asks us to know when another kind of fearlessness is asked for in our actions, our speech, and our words. When to say no with wisdom. When we are really called upon, actually, to protect the well-being of ourselves or another. To protect something from harm is not always heroic. But it can be an instinctive reaching out to heal the wound in another, just as we would reach out to our own bodies. It's a wonderful poem by Joseph Bukhak, where he says, "The old man must have stopped our car 24 times to climb out and gather into his hands the small toads, blinded by our lights and leaping like drops of rain. The rain was falling, a mist about his white hair, and I kept saying, 'You can't save them all. Accept it. Get back in. We've got places to go.' But leathery hands full of wet brown life, knee-deep in the summer roadside grass, he just smiled and said, 'They have places to go, too.'" Just as compassion doesn't measure the worth of any act or response that relieves suffering, neither does it measure suffering itself. You know, some people believe, because of their own story or their own history, that they're somehow unworthy or unlovable or undeserving of attention. And it's very easy to make a hierarchy out of pain. Sometimes I think we face the immense pain in the world. You know, we see some of the people who are so devastated by tragedies in our world, and we can feel, oh, maybe it's self-indulgent to care for my own body or to care for my own heart or to care for my own mind. and we kind of trivialize the suffering we feel in our own life. But genuine compassion really doesn't have those hierarchies or boundaries. How could we possibly even know how to reach out to another if we really don't even know how to reach out to our own ailing body, our own broken heart? Learning the patience, the steadfastness, the listening inwardly to the pain we experience, we learn to listen to all pain. I think we and probably our world are most endangered, above all, by the unwillingness to listen to pain and to understand it. And if we ignore it, we just end up engaging in endless deluded activities that take us away from wisdom and from a trembling heart. So in our practice, we learn about patience. We learn about fearlessness. We learn about intimacy. We learn about embracing suffering. And we learn we can take our seat in the midst of this life to make no distinction between self and other. We can take our seat in the midst of the fires of sorrow. And we can find a heart that trembles. A friend of mine, co-teacher, once said, you know, we cannot attain awakening for ourselves, that we can only participate in the awakening of life. We have just a moment quietly together.